All right, so I had a little story that I wanted to share with you from the animal kingdom.
The animal kingdom, okay.
So,
seven
pajamas, penguins on the bottom. Absolutely. So,
okay, yes.
Like maybe a week ago, it's not important when, I went on a little walk with my partner around Caltech's campus. And we both had some phone calls to make. And so we like walked apart from each other and like each took our separate phone calls and then like met up when we were finished. And
look at you guys, like we're just taking some privacy outside the home, but like still together, just living. Okay.
So when we met back up, Maddie was like, oh, I am like a little bit worried about this turtle in this pond over here. And I was like, what's going on? And there's a turtle pond at Caltech with like all of these rocks and like tons of turtles, and like they lay upon the rocks and it's like shallow so that they can get out. And then there's like a,
okay,
like a gradient part. It's like a, it's four turtles. There's also,
sounds cute.
It's very cute. There's also the lily pad ponds or something. And there's like tadpoles and frogs in there, but it's really deep. Mm-hmm. And it's like the water is like far down from the sides. There was a turtle in the lily pad pond, and it kept coming to the side and, like, grabbing up, but, like,
couldn't. But it couldn't get out.
It was too deep for it to get out because, yeah, like, the water was too low. And Maddie was like, I've never seen – she works there, and she's like, I've never seen turtles in this pond. Like, I don't feel like it's supposed to be in here. Do you know if they can drown? And I was like, oh, my God. Well, like,
and you're like, I don't know about turtles.
They're amphibians. Like, I'm pretty sure they breathe air, but they can just, like, hold their breath for a long time. And so this little guy swam over to us, and I reached down, and I picked him up. And he didn't seem to mind, he or she. They,
did he feel the warm embrace of nature?
It was cold, but we walked it over to, I like held my hand in front of its face to block the wind, like a mini windshield, and walked it over to the turtle pond where it, I thought, belonged, and set it down on the side. It came out of its shell, went into the water, then came back up and looked at us a few times, and we were like, okay, cool. It's a new home. It's got all these friends. This water was thick with turtles, like so many turtles
thick
in the turtle.
Thick with turtles? Like, they were, I want to start calling things thick with turtles. Wow.
Like, okay. They had to be like on top of each other, how many turtles are in this pond. And then,
damn.
So we're like, okay. So we start walking home, and as we're crossing once again the lily pad pond, I see a little head poke out, and I'm like, fuck. There is not another turtle in that lily pad pond.
Was there?
And we go over, and there is another one. And then I'm like, well, there's now, and now there's another, there's now three. Three are in here. I think that maybe, like, it was fine that maybe it was in here. Did we separate it from its immediate
from its family? Oh, my God.
And take it to the city, the big bad city with all the thick, thick turtle water.
Oh, my God. I feel emotional.
I know. I was like, I was probably more upset about it than I should have been. And
I'm upset about it a little bit, just lightly, right now, that I'm like, wait, so what happened? Did you try and return it to its community?
I could never have known which turtle it was in,
oh,
from
it
the
was
turtle.
Thick with turtles. Right? Oh, no.
500 turtles in that pond. And
oh, wow.
The next day,
just start a new
at random,
life.
Maddie was like, oh, I wanted you to know for peace of mind that I looked it up. And turtles don't form social bonds, and they don't have families or care about each other at all.
Oh, thank the Lord. Thank the heavens above. Wow, how much relief do I feel right now that your girlfriend did the important strategic work of determining whether turtles form social bonds so we can all sleep a little easier tonight. Wow.
We can, and that little asshole, since I guess they're all just little assholes, and they are reptiles, you know, we need to remember, like, they don't have, like, emotions, like, they don't feel
shit.
They don't
have big brains, yeah.
It's not like they're a dog, but that turtle is probably really pissed about being there, because in the...
Resources be limited now, you're in the,
they're limited,
you're in the big city.
But they
it's
also...
like renting an apartment in New York, okay.
Turtles don't, it's true, turtles don't form social bonds, but they also don't enjoy each other's company.
Oh no!
So I took this guy
well,
from like this oasis
kind of funny.
To the two other turtles.
Utopia and took him to... turtle hell.
Absolutely.
They're like, yeah, now I'm amongst all these turtles. of which I could care less about, right?
Neutral to negative feelings.
That is so funny. Wow. Yeah.
But it just reminded me of mission trips, so I thought I would talk about it here.
Or
like international, certain international adoptions. That's, you know, you guys can connect the dots on that.
That's right. And on that note, welcome to Why Are You Like This?
Welcome. Fup dates.
Ooh, Fup Date Edition. The weekly podcast here where we dissect some part of human behavior, pseudoscience,
turtle behavior,
regular science, turtle behavior, social patterns, missionaries, just whatever we're noodling on at any given time in order to determine why people are the way that they are. That is Jamie Ryan pissing off the turtles in Los Angeles.
And that is Austin Williams relieved about the reptilian lack of social bonds in Chicago.
I really was. Like, I got, like, sad for it. And see, listen, what everyone's takeaway should be, and it actually, the fact that I sang, like, Lion King, you know-ish at the top of this really should relate to you, that I'm like, yeah, what did the Land Before Time make me think the turtles were feeling for each other, you know? Like,
those were
what turtles, what animated, you know, cowabunga moment has made me be like, yeah, deep bonds within turtles, and we should be upset about this. They don't give a fuck. If anything, they're little assholes.
Some of it, I think, is all the footage we've seen of the baby sea turtles making their way from the sand to the ocean.
And I would blame whatever musical accompaniment they put on those clips that make you feel like, oh, like your heart is like soaring while you watch these little creatures go to the water. And they're like, I don't care that I'm doing this in a group, just where the eggs were laid. These aren't my siblings.
And my mother left after she laid the eggs. I've never seen my mother.
She didn't care about us. It was just a process, okay?
Yep.
Wow. Wow. Oh, man. But welcome, Fupdate Edition here for our tiny nugget of noodling this month. I don't know how much else we're going to be talking about turtles. We'll see if we can work it in.
You'll have to try, yeah, to shoehorn it. We'll see what we can do.
We'll see what we can do. But to that point, Jamie, what are we really getting into today?
Today, we are talking about the 37% rule, something that I had never heard of until earlier last week. And basically what we're talking about is like decision-making, like how and when is too long to wait to make a decision, shopping around, how long do I look for something before I pounce, algorithms perhaps to hack our lives. That's what we're talking about. And
for me, this is like a through line from a previous update where we talked about maximizing and satisficing of like, are you the person who like, this is good enough? Or are you the person who you're like, well, I don't know. I have this great thing, but is there a better version out there? And I think everybody does both of those things, but to different extremes in different circumstances, we should say.
Totally. And so we're talking about like kind of that decision-making process through a different lens, but a similar lens to the maximizing and satisficing conversation. So I will start us off by saying that personally, I have a lot of trouble making like bigger life decisions or even smaller decisions, actually. Like sometimes like figuring out what to do with like a free weekend day can become like a crippling experience.
Just because
so many choices. And also like I'm an Enneagram 7, and so like I'm the person that's trying to like sample everything before I choose, or maybe choose to just try everything, and that's my meal or my whole life, just trying many things. And obviously that sets people like me up for a little bit of a disadvantage of being like a jack of all trades but a master of none, not really developing like depth of knowledge, perhaps not like investing the way that maybe you could have if you would have taken better advantage of certain situations. So
I guess, think that's right. And I was kind of trying to tie it to my Enneagram, you know, when you were talking about your 7. And so I'm a 2. I'm the helper. We're just like bringing the Enneagram into this, but why not? But, you know, I was thinking, I was like, does that play into this at all for me? And I actually think it does. Because I think the part of my Enneagram 2, like something that feels very core to me and maybe to the other 2s I know, is like we like really need everyone to be like having a good time, and we like, you know, we need everybody else to be happy. And so I think for me, if it feels like something is like the moment it seems like people are enjoying themselves, I'm not going to seek an alternative or like rock the boat.
Oh, yeah.
But if somebody seems unhappy, I'll be like, fine, we can try something else. And so I think that's maybe my motivation in a group.
That's very interesting.
For me individually, I'm pretty content in if I think of something that sounds good, like I'm good to stop there.
Mm-hmm.
About most things, I think. I'm specifically thinking a lot about food in this moment, I'm going to be honest.
But. And that's a really tangible example. And I wish I was better at like quickly selecting food in that way rather than driving around wondering what's on the next block.
Sure.
But like in that same vein, I feel like for us and probably our listeners, I have looked at your demographics, our late 20s, early 30s. And late teen years for some of you are a time for
what's
like
up to the kids. Big, you're not kids. Big, you know you're with us.
You're full-ish adults. But this is a time of like super big decisions that last potentially your whole life or a big chunk of your life. So like mm-hmm. we're all choosing right now, or some of us right now are choosing a location to be in semi-permanently or permanently, a partner or partners, our career options, housing, like how we want to allocate our finances, wedding yeah. stuff in every way that I could mean that. And then just like
yeah.
lots of pressure around all of these decisions and like lots of emotions around all of these like semi-permanent decisions that are kind of like, I think what we would maybe think of as like, quote, like starting your life or like when,
yeah,
you know, and like that's not
I do
right mm-hmm. or true, but it is all of these decisions that do start
it's a bit
to
narrative in like Western culture for mm-hmm. sure. And I would even we could rewind it even let's pull back from like our 20s a little bit and let's even like put us in a kind of like a high school college age of like mm-hmm. where are you going to go to school, are you going to go to school, what are you going to major in, what are you I mean, or if you're like going straight to work or you're doing like a trade thing and you want to like, you know, mm-hmm. you're going to go to hair school or like whatever it is. And I think there's so much pressure on like this is going to decide the rest of your life. And
totally. And I think there's not a lot of space to like shop around, like especially when you're in your late teens and like deciding on like college or a trade or something.
But there's all this gravity to these decisions. And mm-hmm. I actually feel like kind of the older I get, like I still sure feel like I'm still faced with like a lot of decisions. And maybe some of it's like the maturity of like experience. But there's this part of me that I'm also like, okay, at some point, these decisions either have felt like less of a big deal, or in some ways, I feel like I am like more reactive than like necessarily like, or that I have to be like more reactive than proactive. Because I feel like a lot of the big things sometimes that happen now, it's me being like, okay, this is the situation or a thing that's arisen, mm-hmm. and how am I going to deal with it? Where I feel like less on like the quest for like the big choices, if that makes sense in some ways. And I feel like the older you get, the more true that is.
Oh, I think so too. Because as we like go down the path of our lives, like every decision that we make, and this is my Enneagram 7 showing, but like every choice mm-hmm. we make is like closing all the other doors in that moment and like moving on mm-hmm. and making choices now from that point. And then you make another decision about, you know, you want to be in a certain city. Okay, now that closes all the other city doors. Now I'm working with, you know, like, I think that that is
let's
why.
Let's say you make the big choice that you want to have kids or that you don't.
And that and informs then so like, many other choices.
Well, it does. And then it also, though, in some ways, then that big choice kind of just determines how you interact with the world. So it's like, okay, like, you are choosing not to have kids. So, like, here's how your life looks and how do you engage with that? Or let's say you have a kid. I mean, obviously you're making choices about how to raise your kid, but like on some level, like people are just like the way that they are. Like,
mm-hmm.
and maybe at some point, especially as people grow, in some ways you're just reacting to the way that your kid is.
That's true.
Rather than like deciding how they are. And that is a choice and it's a really important one, I think, but it's like less your choice. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No. Yeah.
It's like, it's just a different kind of choice, but.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. but has struggling with like too many options, or like, I guess not feeling like the feeling of like there always is potentially something that's a better fit for me out there is like why it took me what felt to me like a very long time to like get into a career. It was really hard to like focus and chase one path when I felt like there were many that were appealing that I could be happy in. And so it was like, how do I figure out like which one is the one that's going to work? Like you can't, you can't figure that out. So
you just, can't know, like you can't know.
You cannot. And so on that note.
And it might change. And I think a lot of people stay put because even if they're not happy, that feels easier or less insurmountable than going through all the other options of like reinventing the wheel and what could you do?
Yeah.
And I'm at a place right now that I'm like, I don't know. Do I want to do something completely different for work? And I don't know. But the thought of trying to figure out what that would be feels crazy.
Oh, of course. I mean, I would imagine that it would feel like the side of a plane was open.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. Yep.
Well, in order to perhaps help you choose what your next right path is later, we're going to dig into, is there a formula, a perhaps mathematical way to know that we're getting the best option? And the answer is sort of, depends on the situation. So we would
depends on who you ask.
It does. And about what, and if they are an Android or not. So we're going to take you through a little article titled, How Many People Should You Date Before Settling Down? Follow the 37% rule. And the title is dating focus, but this is really about any life decision, and I would say is most easily applied to apartment hunting. So,
ooh, I like that. Okay.
I do. This is by Johnny Thompson from April of this year. And so,
what up, Johnny?
Austin,
program.
Hit us with an introductory example.
Well, listen, Jamie said apartment shopping. We're going to talk about it. I love an introductory example. Meet Macy. Macy's about to move. She's scored a promotion and she's tired of the guy above her, you know, blasting her ears out with his French horn every day. So she books a few viewings with her real estate agent and starts looking at some houses. She looks at three places. She falls in love, which, you know, listen, there's something to be said for object sexuality and people dating buildings, but we'll keep going. She falls in love with a house that has a huge backyard and a nice open plan kitchen, which I'm like, those sound like nice features. I'm interested. Okay. So what's more, the school down the road has a great reputation, which matters to some people. So she is all set. She puts in an offer. But then like that night in her mind, she's like laying awake in bed. Maybe she smoked a little weed. That's when I ask these kinds of questions of myself. And she says, what if the next house is better? And she can't shake the thought. You know, what if it has a bigger backyard? Maybe it has a double bigger garage. Titties. What if it's fucking cheaper? Yeah. You know, maybe there are bigger tits on this object. Okay. We have found ourselves in this situation. All of us. Okay. Whether we're considering job offers, buying a house, the dating thing, sure. But the apartment hunting, I think, is a great example. And when it comes to like love, you know, the article wants us to push us into like, how many people do you date before settling down? And I think everybody could. Yeah. I mean, come on. And I think everybody could tell you that. I mean, nothing in life is purely algorithmic, but we'll see how this kind of can play into. And altogether, you know, it's a problem that bridges mathematics and psychology, which we love here at Why Are You Like This. And the name of this little problem solver, if you will, or what we're looking at is the optimal stopping problem.
Which so doesn't sound like much.
Doesn't sound like much, but I'm like, okay, you're trying to optimize. When do you stop?
That's true. Okay, yeah. So the optimal stopping problem, the 37% rule. The mathematical question for Macy, our would-be dater looking for an apartment or now love in this article, concerns Max.
Which could be with a house. She could be dating the house. I'm just putting
it
out there.
It seems like all signs are pointing to
She's dating the house.
A fondling of the home, yes. An inspection.
I don't know how she uses the automatic garage door opener, but we could find out.
I don't know. Yeah. So Macy, who is in deep love with this one apartment and also considering settling down with it, is concerned about maximizing probabilities. And it's going to be asking just like, how long do you spend sampling the options to give the optimum chance of success in the final decision? So mathematicians have given us allegedly an answer that I've already told you. It's 37%. And the basic idea, what does this mean, is like, if you're going to need to make a decision from 100 options, because that's a really easy number, then you should like test or shop around on the first 37 options. So the 37% rule, they tell us, is not some mindless automatic thing. It's a calibration period where you're just like testing and identifying what works and what doesn't. So from looking at this 37%, we're figuring out like what is the most important to us, what is the best, and like what that threshold is, and then any subsequent options that beat what our benchmark standard is, they say like you should stick with that to get ultimately the quote best ultimate outcome. So
they would.
They're androids though. We need to remember. Let's take an example. So imagine you're finding yourself single, wanting a relationship. And
with a house.
Perhaps with a house. And we are not here to judge about that or what kinds of inspections you're doing late at night.
Maybe you're in exploring, you know, bestiality with a turtle. See, told you I'd make it happen. Okay.
Wow. It's an almost... You know what? It's fine. It's there. Thank you. So
it's the only way I was going to do it. We can move on now. Okay.
It's excellent. Anyway, so you decide you're going to go on 10 dates over a few months. And in the 37% rule, if you're going to approach it that way, would tell you that you should enjoy yourself on the first 3 dates, have a laugh, a drink or two, but do not arrange a second date with any of them. You can do better, they say. Shit. This sounds like a great grandmother. Older people are always saying to like not like date just one person. Like they're always like, I don't know. Anyway, that's for another time.
I think maybe some of that is coming from people who are worried that they satisfied.
Excellent point.
I think that it comes from older people because I think that's some energetic hindsight.
It is probably a little bit.
Because maybe they're looking back and they're going, did I maximize? Am I happy? What would it be like, even if I am happy, if my life looked really different?
Mm-hmm. No, we all think about that. But they tell
we
us.
We all do.
So you're going to go on these first 3 dates. And even if you like the person, you're not going to like arrange any kind of follow-up. And what the 37% rule tells us is that the next best date that you have after you've done that testing period of the 3 dates is the keeper. So like if you go on date number 4 and they are worse than one of your first 3 dates, nope. Keep moving on. But as soon as someone is better than the best of those first 3, this algorithm would tell us to go ahead and marry that person. Sight unseen.
Which is a wild thought.
Well, not sight unseen. That doesn't make any sense. But second date unseen, if you will. So there's a guy named Brian Christian who may or may not be an android. And in his book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, he uses the 37% rule to help Macy from our opening example. She's back. And he writes, quote, if you want the best odds of getting the apartment, Macy, spend 37% of your apartment hunt, which translates to if you're looking for 1 month, and this was helpful for me, if you're going to look for an apartment for 1 month, your 37% is 11 days. So for 11 days, Macy should non-committally explore options. Know that she's not going to even fill out an application for any of those places. But then after those first 11 days, she should be prepared to immediately commit, deposit and all, to the very first place that she sees that beats whatever she's already seen. And Brian says that this is not merely an intuitively satisfying compromise between looking and leaping, but it is probably the optimal solution. I don't know.
It might be. Totally. It might be optimal.
Yeah.
Listen, it's interesting because we're applying mathematics to life, right? And mathematics offer us this like best answer to this all, you know, optimal stopping problem. But let's get to it. We, you know, humans are not rational. We're not probability crunching machines. I mean, you talk to anybody, you take any economics class, the first thing they say to you is like, assume the market's rational. Well, to listen, even the opposite is usually true.
Yeah.
Right. The opposite is usually true. I'm like, what a great way to teach something theoretical that, I don't know, psychology, it's, I have questions about econ. Just in terms of consumer behavior, don't come for me. Okay. So we're all, you know, infuriatingly and cutely different and chaotic and messy. And okay, we'll take it. But it falls on psychology to tell us how we actually will behave, not just math, right? And so in psychology and economics, there is what's known as this explore-exploit trade-off. And this is where you ask whether you should go with a guaranteed, air quotes, like win, that's your exploit, or the risk of going somewhere else for an unknown outcome, that's your explore. And so, I mean, our girl Macy, it's like, she loves the house. That's your guaranteed win.
She's wet for it, yeah.
But yeah, she's wet for this house in a sexual way, okay? Yeah. Do you go out and see if you could be like, you know, wetter for another house?
Totally.
And so the degree to which someone's going to explore or exploit whatever they're willing to do is going to depend on obviously a host of factors. Some of that's going to have to do with like how curious and risk-seeking, you know, we are.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the kinds of risks for different people. I think when money is involved, like financial risks are something that some people are more or less comfortable with. Emotional risks are different.
Resource
the risk of like embarrassment.
So.
Yeah, so many things. And there's some research out there that was published in a publication called Nature. And the extremes of being too exploitive or too explorative are what are really talked about and what leaves us at a disadvantage. And it probably goes without saying that a person who exploits too much could, you know, promote habit formation, while the person who explores too much, that's your kind of, to Jamie's earlier point, jack of all trades but master of none. Overexploiters, they become stuck in a rut. Maybe you're lacking the motivation and get bored. Maybe this is the person who, like I was alluding to, says, I don't think I want to do this job for forever, but it seems so insurmountable to explore and figure out what I want to do. I'm just going to chill.
Mm-hmm.
Your over-explorer lacks expertise. Maybe they're never fully, you know, willing to experience something really in depth. And just for the record, the jack of all trades but master of none, that's not the whole phrase. I'm just inserting this. But it's actually a jack of all trades but a master of none. And it ends somehow with like is better than a master of one, I think. So it's actually positive to the jack of all trades.
Look
but
at that.
Thank you. That's for another time. Listen, guys, that's why you don't take every quote out of context. Okay. Anyway. What they say in this research is that the most advantageous behaviors occur around a point of balance between the two being, you know, our exploring and our exploiting. And obviously different people, you know, different things. So, and different things at different times, you know, I throw out those things that maybe somebody's like, hey, you know, I'm this, you know, entrepreneur and I'm willing to like explore and do some things. Maybe I've got some money to throw around. Teenagers, just because frontal cortex stuff and figuring out your identity, obviously more of an explorer. And then adults, and then people who maybe are like managing a team or like not that entrepreneur, but that person who's like maybe feels like a greater onus over a group of people. Those are more of your exploiters. Okay. So
they need that sure thing.
It's yeah, exactly. And so it was thrown out to us in this article, like, try testing yourself with three questions to see where you fall. So, Jamie, I'm going to hit you with them, and I'd like to see what you think.
Yes.
If you are visiting a city you know vaguely well, will you go to a restaurant you know is nice, or will you try somewhere new? I'm going to give you the example of you come to Chicago, but I'm not here. Do you go somewhere you know you like, or are you going to try something new?
It depends on who I'm with. If I'm with people who are familiar with Chicago and have been to, like, everywhere I've been
to. You're alone.
If I'm alone, really depends on the mood, but probably go somewhere new.
Cool. Okay.
I didn't live in Chicago. I don't have, like, nostalgia feelings for it. I don't have, like, a place that's mine, you know?
I do know. That's a, I like you bringing in the nostalgia factor because I do feel like that matters too.
Totally. Because like if I visit Cincinnati, there's like some spots that I need to hit like for nostalgia reasons.
Yeah, totally. Well, let's flip the table and then like, make it monetary. So if you're playing like, you know, penny slots or whatever, you've
which
been,
I am.
You know, I know you're out here with these penny slots. Okay, but if you're somewhere and you have a payout of $50, are you going to stay or are you going to play, stay and play? Or are you going to, like, explore and see maybe if other things would have, like, a bigger payout? Or, like, what are you going to do?
When I have been in gambling situations.
Go on.
I do typically try to, like, watch for a little while and then move away from whatever is paying out. And so I actually feel like gambling is maybe one of the only areas where I use the 37% rule maybe already, because I definitely have a period of like having a drink, walking around, checking out the floor.
Checking out the floor, seeing what's going down. Okay, I see you. I respect that. I mean, I feel like that's an easier one because a lot of us, not everyone, some people are really like riding on streaks and luck and stuff, but I think many people will say, okay, I understand something about this. It's like probability and like math and statistics. So like maybe I'll try and play the game that the machines are playing, right?
Exactly. Like, for example, this is advice to everyone, and it was true at least 5 years ago, not sure about now, but if you're in a casino, the machines near the bathrooms pay out more because it's a higher traffic area and the casino wants the illusion of a lot of payouts.
Well, just you guys, we learned something important just now. Okay. I'll be playing those slots by the toilets. Okay. When you're playing a game, this is my third question for you. So not a slot, not a gambling thing, just a game.
Mm-hmm.
And I have strong opinions about this, so I want to hear where you go. Mm-hmm. Do you tend to stick to the same tactics or mix it up each time?
I unfortunately, and to my own detriment, typically mix it up each time. It's like sometimes really hard for me to repeat the same sequence of either like gameplays or if I'm working on editing something like series of actions on what I'm working on. And unfortunately, I think if I had more consistency in both games and in my like projects, I would probably be a little faster rather than constantly trying new methods.
I can appreciate that. I actually, my feeling on this game bit is I feel differently in different kind of games. Mm. If the game is physical, I'm probably going to stick to something similar that I feel like can work. You know, whether I'm like, ooh, like I can't really throw, but I can be fast.
Yeah,
or abilities. Like if some sort of like physical obstacle, I'm trying to like go fast. I'm like trying to perfect the technique. But if it's something like you and I are young children playing Connect Four and I'm trying to psychologically mess with you.
You owe me. You got to so mix it up. Money. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Or like, you know, Battleship or all these things. I'm like, that's where I kind of want to be like.
Rock, paper, scissors. You really got to mix it up on that one.
Yeah. So when it becomes like a little bit psychological, I think I'm like chasing that mix up to keep other people on their feet. But for something that's like, you know, hitting a target, archery, I don't know, darts, I'm probably going the same way every time.
Well, I think actually that's like a perfect lead in to this little last blurb that we'd like to hear from Johnny, our author. And that's basically like that. People, again, are not robots, and there are situations where the 37% rule can easily be applied and places where it cannot. So, like, you saying that you would have a different approach for archery rather than, like, Connect Four or Battleship, I think, to me, there is parallel to trying to apply the 37% rule to apartment hunting versus a relationship where
or a relationship that you have with this house, okay?
Absolutely, and we cannot forget about the house and that in Macy's eyes, the house also has feelings, unlike the turtles.
Absolutely, yes.
So Johnny tells us.
Oh, that is the best turtle callback we could have had. Okay. So much better than my bestiality slip-in. I thought we were done. That's the golden ticket. We can't let it go by without acknowledgement. Okay, sorry, carry on.
I appreciate you. Oh, So relationships are messy when it comes to trying to apply the 37% rule. So if we try to apply that, like as a general principle, it makes sense to experience a variety of different dates before you familiarize yourself. You know, you do, I would advise like you to date a few people.
I root for more than one person.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Just have some experiences. So basically they're saying like, as a general principle, it does make sense to date a lot of different people. But also like in the vein of relationships aren't like necessarily algorithm friendly. Like you could go on your very first date of this string of people that you're going to test out. And maybe that first date like is the love of your life. Or maybe just like in this string of dates, the person that you click with instantly and like no one could make you happier is the second person or the third person. And like, it's just, who's to say also that like you wouldn't return to a past date or relationship because maybe you like one of the first three people you were like, after you've dated seven people, you're like, damn, like still no one is better than date number three. Like all along they were the best. And so
it happens.
It definitely does. And so the biggest problem with the 37% rule or the idea of exploring when applied to dating is that, of course, one date is not ever enough. Sometimes even like 10 to 100 dates are like not enough to like know a person for real. And also like it's really chance and you could meet the person that you want on the first date. And as a general rule, though, they say that 37% is like a pretty good one. Just like let's be aware that everything isn't math. So it's good when it comes to things like buying things, making life decisions like houses, apartments, maybe even cities or jobs. It's kind of like a safe starting point. And so there's a lot of wisdom to be had from like sampling what your options are before you decide on it. It's going to be about like doing research, calibrating your expectations, and just kind of like ultimately what learning what makes something good or bad and what you want. So like since that's the only reason why I'm like advocating dating more than one person as we talk about this.
Well, totally.
Is because
but not just.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, not just even like, I mean, I'm with you on advocating more than one for sure. But I also, one of the things I think about is even from those little questions we did with like games and gambling and, you know, restaurants or whatever, it's so much, it's circumstantial. You're like, well, different cities, I would maybe do something different or different kinds of games, I would do something different. And I think this is like the not romantic thing you're not supposed to say, but I mean, so much of dating and romance is time. And like, I adore my partner. They're, you know, all the things and then some. But I guess I'm not like a person who believes that we were like two people who were like cosmically predestined to find each other. And I think that like I was in the right place to meet someone that I could really be with and like build a life with and do a lot of really cool things with and like be available to emotionally and like more capable of things. And I think I could have met him at a different time and it could have not worked. And I could have met someone else at the same time that I met him and it could have worked. And I don't think that that diminishes.
No.
Things. And I think it's the same thing too. You think about like properties or something. It's like, it's you can't afford the same things. Like the same, you know what I mean? It's, I mean, it's not obviously it's not the same thing, but like it's circumstantially like things are different. And I don't think that because more than one thing could work, it diminishes like the joy of when something is good. But
not at all.
I do think it's like, to that point too, it's like get out there and have some experiences because at the same time, if I was in a good place and like a, I think a receptive like dating sphere when we met, but let's say I had had no real like dating experience, I probably could have like jumped on any fucking crazy train. Okay.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%. And I to call back to
I've
like,
been at times in my life that I've jumped on crazy trains, okay?
we've all done it. We've all made some poor choices. But like to call back to like my struggles in like choosing a career path, it's the same thing as like what we're talking about like not a soulmate basically. Like I could have been happy in many different jobs and career paths. It took me a long time to choose because I knew that many of them could make me happy and it was hard to choose which one. And I'll say right now, like, I'm happy where I am, but I feel confident I could be equally happy doing something else. So
that's right.
It is that really
is right.
But I wouldn't have been happy if I hadn't finally chosen, like just waiting in limbo and like doing like mm-hmm. several different things like would not have continued to work for me at all. And so like there definitely is merit in like just choosing sometimes.
I think that's right. I think there's something to maybe the way I would put that, not even just choosing, but like being willing to accept when something good comes your way and being willing to like and able to like receive that and not like question it or think that it should be different, that it could just be like a good thing and you can just like lean into that, and rather than like find the flaws or wonder if there's something that's more good or whatever it is.
Okay, yeah, be less skeptical. I hear you.
There's something to that, you know what I mean?
No, there totally is. I agree. And I think that like we all could probably like make ourselves really unhappy by thinking about like what are all the options that we could have come across that we didn't give ourselves the option for. And so that's not productive. We won't do that.
Yeah. Well, that's fucking true.
Yeah. But I wanted to ask you if you use any other like life algorithms or anything, if there's any other little like, and maybe not, but like any other like weird little life hacks or like things like that that you do.
Well, I don't know if this is algorithmic, but I think that my boo and I, we keep like running lists of things that are like in different cities and also like things that are in our city. And when we also keep a list of like to watch TV shows or to watch movies that we're like, oh, we should watch that together sometime, or you've never seen that, or I'd like to watch it with you. We both love that movie. We should X, Y, and Z. And then when we don't know what to do, we do have like a piggy bank of here are restaurants we've said we wanted to try. Here are movies we said we would watch. And there's usually something on there. And so I don't know if that's like mathematical in any kind of statistic way, but I do think we like probably have narrowed our choices and like set ourselves up with success other than it feeling like the infinite abyss. And I think that's the hardest part of the optimal stopping kind of question.
Totally.
You've given yourself infinite answers. And so the age old, like people being like, I don't know what we should do for dinner, because it's like, we could literally do anything. And if you have like a list,
I'm a big,
and
I
then
will
you're
second
not trying
this.
To add to it.
I'm a big proponent of these lists. It saves a lot of, ultimately a lot of your life. If I add up all the time that my partner and I have saved by consulting, just like you said, the lists of restaurants we want to try, restaurants we already like, or like things we want to do in different cities, it takes the pressure, the paralysis, and like the time that you have to spend to hit that 37% of like, what do we do? Because even conversationally, if you're trying to decide where to go for dinner, there is the period of talking through five or six restaurants that maybe you don't want to go to and then choosing.
Yeah.
And so having these lists really almost like eliminates having to fuck with this algorithm at all when choosing
it's a restaurant. Really different to be like, we'd like to watch a movie tonight, let's look at our list of movies, than being like, we'd
Doom
like to watch
scroll.
A movie tonight, let's open up the interface of Netflix and feel paralyzed.
Not Netflix. Totally. Yeah, I think that everyone should do that. And that's my firm, unsolicited advice. But
that's my little hack, I guess. I think that's the closest thing I probably come to something kind of mathematical for something. But I've also another good rule I've heard, you know, you think about like big parties and a lot of times for people like wedding stuff and people will get like guest list paralysis. But I heard somebody's rule one time that they were like, you know, you always have exceptions for the people who like live in another country or it's just like something totally different. And if you want them, have them. But if you have somebody who's you're on the fence of like, should I invite this person to X, Y, and Z? And in this case, they were talking about weddings. They're like, I always say, if you haven't shared a meal with them in a year and you're not sure, no.
Well, and this is outside proof. This is a pre-COVID world, but yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. For sure. Now it's like, I haven't seen anyone in 3 years. But
no, but previously, I am here for that rule, definitely.
I think there's something like a, I like a good opt-out rule for the things you're on the fence of, or like, should I or shouldn't I? Or like,
permission.
Should I
really
keep this book that I haven't read? I just went through a move, and so I think I've thought a lot about purging and some of the criteria you use for that. But. Yeah,
I made some Goodwill bags and was a little pushy with my partner about which things needed to be removed. And I also found myself asking her a lot of rhetorical questions about when the last time something was worn or used, correct? And how important the emotional attachment to the item was. Yes, if we're not going to wear it.
You're out here. You're out here doing it. Do you have anything really mathematical that you do or any kind of like thought process like that really?
I would say thought process, definitely. We've talked extensively or maybe just briefly about my feelings on Fibonacci numbers, which I don't have time to explain right now. But
I mean, that's a whole nother episode, but we love the Fibonacci. Mm.
But I do think that algorithms can be applied to humans. I think that maybe we...
I think that's right.
I think that we don't have complex enough algorithms yet to understand like human emotion and maybe kind of like, I don't know. I know this sounds crazy, but I really believe that like every person could be like mathematically broken down and predicted if we could get good enough at like turning behavior into numbers.
I think we could get close. I don't think we could ever be at 100% because people do irrational, unprovoked things all the time, myself included.
Totally, but I'm like,
I do all sorts of shit that I'm like, nobody could have seen that coming. I didn't even see it coming.
Or could they?
I don't think so.
The lizard alien overlords. The turtles will know.
The hollow earth. Okay.
No, I don't know. I don't have like a lot of other hacks, truly besides the list one that you said, which I do think is a mathematical hack. And
advice we could all enjoy, perhaps. Limit your choices.
Absolutely. We should always be limiting. Listen, Barack Obama only wore a couple colors of suits for that reason.
That is the second time you've brought that up recently, and I think it really has to do with the terror of the tan suit, but I digress.
I think about it a lot when I'm trying to simplify my own decisions. Anyway.
You're like, Barack Obama, why do you always use him in a couple suits? Why don't we go like Steve Jobs had one outfit? You know, that's like more tangible.
I guess. That's also the same. It's anyone with a signature look. I'm like, you're leaning into
Doug
it.
Funny.
It's saving you a lot of time.
Yeah, Pepper I think Ann. That's right.
Absolutely. So any other closing feelings or thoughts on these percentages?
I just want to see what people's personal brand outfits are. That's all.
Yeah. And if you could only wear, one thing, a closet full of one outfit, what is it? What's the most
you? A la Doug Funny, man.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be a sweater vest, I'll tell you that much. Listen, we want to hear about your outfits and your algorithmic choices. And as always, you can let us know about them on the internet via email at whyyoulikethispod@gmail.com, on Instagram at whyyoulikethispod, and on Twitter at WAYLTTweets. I think we bid you adieu, and we will see you next week.
We will, for a crazy ass time. Buckle up. If you enjoyed The Virgin Daughters, we are doing something called a courtship next week where an adult woman moves in with a spiritually adoptive family who will choose a husband for her.
Listen, you guys, we don't have time, but I hope that's the teaser or trailer that you needed. Come along indeed.
Bye.
Bye.